Welcome, warrior. You are listening to Bound by Honor, the Klingon Assault Group Book Review Podcast. Your hosts, Jorn Vestai Vampyr and Jajim Tai Jajim, will explore Klingon culture as it appears in Star Trek literature. Perhaps you yourself can hear the cry of your inner warrior. If so, go to www.kag.org and make your presence known. Learn how to join the Klingon Assault Group and begin your journey along the way of the warrior. Now, here are your hosts, Kapla. Greetings. Welcome to Bound by Honor, the Klingon Book Review Podcast. I am one of your hosts, Jajim.
And I am Jorn, challenging you to read more.
Yes, everybody needs to read more. Today, we are going to be looking at a book called Her Klingon Soul, the third book in the Day of Honor series, authored by Michael Jan Friedman and published in October 1997. Jorn, give us a brief summary of this plot.
If we take a look at the back of the book, we see that even light years from the Klingon Empire, the Day of Honor remains an occasion of great importance, and sometimes honor is found in the most unexpected places. Polana Taurus has never cared for the Day of Honor. Ashamed of her Klingon heritage, she regards the holiday as an unwanted reminder of all she has struggled to repress. Besides, something awful always seems to happen to her. Her luck seems to be running true to form when she and Harry Kim are captured by alien slavers, imprisoned by the enigmatic Rosada, forced to mine for deadly radioactive ore. Taurus will need all her strength and cunning to survive, and her honor as well.
Yeah, so I thought it was a pretty good book. What were your overall impressions of this?
As far as a novel is concerned, I would have to say that this would make a good episode for Voyager and not so much a good novel for Star Trek. Now, I don't know if that makes any sense to you, but it reads like the action story that Voyager was without really going in depth into what B'Elanna has to go through to maintain her honor, to retrieve her honor, and to understand her honor.
I'm not sure why this was included myself in the Day of Honor series, other than the story kicks off with B'Elanna rejecting her heritage on the Day of Honor, and then later on at the end of the book celebrating the Day of Honor. I guess there was at least mention of the holiday in the book. As we know, Mike Friedman does have a tendency to take stories in unexpected directions, just like he did in the last book we talked about in Kalis.
But he took Kalis in a direction that became interesting. He took Kalis somewhere that let us see more of what all went on in the mind of Kalis to understand his character a little bit better. We don't see that so much in this book, the way we really don't see a lot of character development in any particular individual episode of Voyager.
Mm-hmm. But, I enjoyed the book and appreciated the length. The shortness of the story allowed the story to keep moving along, even though there were some places in there where we might have liked to know a little more. But we all know, how B'Elanna disdains her Klingon heritage and really wants nothing to do with it. And we see that right in the beginning of the book when everybody's wishing her happy Day of Honor, and Neelix even makes her a traditional Day of Honor meal, and she just about comes unglued. And then along with B'Elanna and Harry's story being captured and enslaved, we had a story with someone named Pakria, who has a disease, and she is rejecting the cure for her disease because the cure was discovered by a race of people called the Zendikar, and she wasn't going and being her race was decimated by them, she wasn't going to use their cure, which gave her kind of a sense of honor that she wasn't going to use that. She got her mind was changed towards the end of the book by Kes, who showed her a holodeck program of this doctor who told Pacria that he would have been just as happy if she died being stubborn and not using the cure, which, you know, she decided, okay, I'm going to go ahead and get cured because it would probably upset this doctor. One of the things that kind of puzzled me, though, is how Pacria just accepted Kes's evidence without questioning it or without questioning whether Kes was being honest or if she was just trying to get Pacria to take the cure and go on living.
One of the things that got me, though, and this is a major criticism of most all of Star Trek, why was the doctor working on a cure for a disease for an alien race, Pacria's race, if he didn't care a thing about whether that race lived or died? Because for the most part, genetics are different enough between the animals here on Earth that diseases are not communicable between species, let alone races.
That's often true. However, there are diseases that are communicable. For instance, my daughter's hamster, well, or miniature targ if you want, but hamsters are able to catch human colds, and sometimes, oftentimes, those are fatal to those little animals. So what puzzled me was that the doctor was unable to find an alternate cure. With his access to the vast database of knowledge from the Alpha Quadrant and the Delta Quadrant and the Beta Quadrant, for that matter, he should have been able to make correlations between the two species enough that he should find something similar that would, maybe with just a little bit of tweaking, it might work.
I don't know. This gets back to the point I was making earlier about diseases and populations being so dissimilar that a lot of the diseases can't cross between species, or like I said, between races. So the fact that you're looking at a Delta Quadrant disease with Alpha Quadrant, Beta Quadrant, and a little bit of Delta Quadrant medical knowledge may not be enough to bridge that gap, but he still should have been able to find little things that he could have done that would have relieved the symptoms, that could have prolonged her life while he did a more in-depth search for the cure. Because on Voyager, he is the only being that can really multitask. He could be taking care of his patients and researching a cure for his patient at the same time.
Well, that's very true. You know, if nothing else, the doctor could have put her in stasis too, for that matter, until he was able to find a cure.
What? You're telling me the doctor had more options than just let her die?
Well, but the thing is she chose to allow herself to die. And the doctor stated very clearly, you know, I can't treat somebody that refuses treatment. It is not ethical. Now, we've seen ethics go out the window many, many times in science fiction where a doctor goes ahead and does something that the patient or the patient's family does not want. But, you know, I think our doctor here is hanging on to his ethical obligations. And hey, if the patient chooses to die, they can't do much to help them with that. It was mostly Kes who was pushing for Pacria to not allow herself to die.
Let's go back and take a look at the doctor's ethics there for a second. Pacria, or however you pronounce her name, did not choose to die. She chose not to take the treatment by her oppressors that killed most of her population.
Okay, yeah.
The doctor could easily have suggested other courses of action had he chose to. So I'm saying the doctor had an ethical dilemma that he should have been filling with alternatives for the patient to choose from.
Didn't it say in the book that he was researching that? He was looking through his database and, you know, all the while? I don't remember. I thought the doctor was doing a study, you know, as he was doing his other work.
He can multitask. Yes, that is very easy for a computer to do.
Yeah. So anyway, what did you think about Kes's solution of showing her the Zendikon doctor, who obviously, I mean, this guy looked a lot like Joseph Mengele to me.
And the reason for that was this whole research program was patterned off what the Nazis did in World War II.
Okay. Well, I wondered.
But that's what struck me right off the bat, because that's we're seeing a writer start talking about people who have been enslaved or subdued and are being used as test subjects. Well, that goes right back to the Nazis in World War II, what they were doing to the Jews and other races.
Yeah. Yeah, the experimentation, trying to get everybody to look Aryan, messing around with genetics when they really had no resources to do so.
Well, they were also trying to find cures for diseases with deadly experiments.
Yeah, it was a bad scene all the way around, and as this was painted to be a very bad scene all the way around. So another difficulty I kind of had with the story was one of the things that prompted the Voyager to move on and keep going was they needed to find food, and they were very, very low on food reserves, and it seemed like they had become quite desperate to go and find food. And, you know, I find that kind of difficult that Captain Janeway would allow reserves to get that low before they went looking for more resources.
That didn't bother me so much, because space is very, very, very large. The distance between planets is extreme, and the probability that a planetary system has a planet in it that has the organics that humans can use to digest is not all that high. Because even if you have organics on the planet, they have to be the right type of organics for humans to be able to ingest them. Stereochemistry shows that you can have two molecules that are mirror images of each other, and the molecules will do different things. So you can have a protein or a sugar that has a mirror image of itself. One of them can be, you know, life-sustaining, and the other can be, forget it, I ain't doing nothing for you, chum.
You know, it's funny you mention that, because in college, I took an astronomy course as an elective. It had nothing to do with my major, but we had to take so many electives and took astronomy, and we learned about that very thing. And what the professor talked about was there are left-handed molecules and right-handed molecules. And that
quite literally.
Yeah. And humans can digest and assimilate nutrients from left-handed molecules, but not right-handed molecules. So you could land on a planet where the nutrients are made up of right-handed molecules. You can eat all you want, and you're still going to starve to death because your body will not use the nutrients from right-handed molecules.
It will just excrete everything you've taken in.
Yeah, there's, and you know, I found that kind of fascinating. I had never heard that before.
No, it quite literally is upper level chemistry. So Yeah, your astronomy teacher was kicking it up there a notch for you guys.
Oh, he was exceptional. He was a lot of fun. And I did learn a lot in that course and really enjoyed it. Now, you brought up slaves as part of this, and you kind of had a problem with the slaves.
There's all kinds of problems with slaves. First of all, as a workforce, they're not any good. They need a lot of overseeing, and they need a lot of constant oversight, constant control. Whereas if you could design machines to do the same thing, and what are we talking here? We're talking processing ore, a very repetitive function. Why don't they use machines to process the ore?
I hadn't even thought of that. No, they had the people doing it. They were loading machines for the processing, but were they the mining? They were using slave labor for mining, weren't they?
But even then, you can design machines to go in and do the actual digging. Or, for that matter, if you're mining an asteroid, just blow it up. Collect the pieces later.
Yeah. Well, in your notes, you have the slaves are expensive to acquire and you don't waste them. And it did seem like they behaved like their slaves were a never-ending resource that they really didn't have to take any care of. They were exploited for their work, and then during off hours, they were exploited for entertainment by the people that were overseeing them. And they just never seemed to get a break. You know, they'd be in the middle of a rest period, and someone would come in and wake them up and beat the hell out of somebody for no apparent reason.
Or stir them up so they'd beat the hell out of each other and, in some cases, kill each other, another waste of that slave resource. This gets back to what happened in the southern states of the United States when England and the rest of the world banned slavery. The United States could no longer import slaves into the country and had to make do with what they had. But it seemed to me like this race felt slaves were a never-ending supply. They could just go out and get some ore and beat the crap out of them. And the ore that they were mining gave them mere days of life expectancy anyway. And that was another problem I had. If you're going to have to pull in a highly expensive commodity like a slave, why aren't you protecting that slave from dying from the very activity you want him to do? Were there no protective garments the slaves could wear? Were there no protective drugs? Well, that'd be another issue. If you were using drugs, you wouldn't know what species would react to what drug. But there had to be some protective measures they could take to protect their slaves, to protect their investments.
Yeah, and there was none whatsoever, because it was mentioned several times throughout the story how B'Elanna and Harry's uniforms were becoming more and more tattered as time goes on, and at the end they were unrecognizable as Starfleet uniforms.
Okay, at that point, if I recall, the Kazon was using a shuttle and cruiser to decoy Voyager in a different direction than their other shuttle was going to take the prisoners away from the scene where they captured them. And that don't make a whole lot of sense if you just have a second cruiser or hide the first cruiser or whatever. The cruiser could go much faster and stay away from Voyager much more easily than a mere shuttlecraft could.
You know, the Kazon really didn't seem to play a huge part in the book that at all, really. They were just kind of there. And, you know, it was the, what are they called? The Nogroth that were the real antagonists in this story.
Yeah, the Kazan were just kind of there to form the bridge to get Harry and B'Elanna to the Nogra and to their enslavement.
Yeah, which I was kind of okay with. I am not a big fan of the Kazan anyway. I remember when I watched Voyager, when their storyline pretty well came to an end, I was kind of relieved because they were supposed to be the Klingons of the Delta Quadrant. And, you know, it just never really kind of worked out that way, because while Klingons behave with honor, it seemed like the Kazan had none whatsoever.
And then, like you said, when the Kazan story came to an end, they kept bringing them back.
Yeah, but at least it wasn't an ongoing thing. It was here they'd come back for a little bit, but they didn't hang around very long.
Which bothered me in the sense that how big was the Kazan Empire? Because if you stop and think of the speed that Voyager was proceeding at to get out of the quadrant, it should have been away from any star empire, unless that star empire was totally galactic, within a matter of a couple of weeks.
It did seem like the Kazan were kind of nomadic too. At least several tribes of them were, because as you know, they were peppered all over the place.
But by the same token, the Mongols didn't sack Paris.
No, they didn't.
There has to be a limit to how far the empire has expanded.
Well, we see that as an example of Rome. I mean, you know, they finally, you know, they didn't take care of their resources nearby, and they continually had to conquer farther and farther away from Rome in order to get resources that they needed to sustain their society. And at some point it becomes impractical to go any farther, because, you know, either the resources run out or you're spread so thin that you're going to get defeated wherever you go.
Which is why I think that Voyager should have outrun the Kazan long before the end of first season.
Yeah. So B'Elanna and Kim, they were in a difficult fight for survival that had exhausted them nearly to the point of being unable to function. I like the way B'Elanna tapped into her Klingon stamina to keep herself from giving up and to motivate Kim not to give up, and not to mention the other slaves that joined in with her to eventually get them to escape and get back to Voyager.
Without knowing that she was going to be able to get back to Voyager, because through all this, she had no idea if Janeway even knew where she was. She was hoping, but she didn't know.
Well, then we come back to Pakria, who helped a lot with finding Voyager, and, you know, absolutely neither, you know, they were both sure that Voyager was looking for them and trying to find them, because that's what Starfleet would do. But whether they were going to be found or not, it was a huge question. And I think actually they were kind of surprised when Voyager did show up on the scene.
Well, they were out in space at the time.
Yeah. So it's well known that B'Elanna leans toward rejecting her Klingon heritage at all costs. But as far as I'm concerned, whether she likes it or not, it is a part of her that helped her survive in this difficult situation numerous times.
And not just this situation. You see it happen often on the television show.
Yeah. So, you know, that kind of leads me to want to discuss a little more about B'Elanna's reaction to the Day of Honor and her Klingon persona altogether. Why? I'm trying to remember why she decided to reject that. And wasn't it because her mother left?
No, her father, I think, left.
Okay. So, you know, was she just too human to be able to appreciate what it meant to be Klingon, or did her mother push too hard, or what was the situation?
They were on a human colony, and she was constantly being teased, put down, picked on because of the fact that she was part Klingon.
I imagine she probably would have gotten in a lot of trouble when her anger would take over and she would retaliate for that brutality.
Yes, she did.
Yeah. But, you know, her being Klingon and tapping into that side of her persona helped her a great deal in this situation, because Ordagar, the Nogra prisoner, saw B'Elanna's honor as well as Harry's honor and came to her aid several times to keep her from getting hurt.
Now that you mention that, I'm thinking that as a plot hole, actually. Here we've got two separate species, different sides of the galaxy, and they can recognize acts of honor in each other. Culturally, shouldn't the two races have different definitions of honor, different ways of expressing the honor, different ways of being honorable?
Perhaps. But wouldn't there be a common sense of certain things that would be conceived as honorable no matter where you go?
Yes, there would. And you may have to dig to find those things. It may not be as obvious as it is in this story to be seen so quickly. It may take a while for that degree of honor to manifest itself in a way that both races can identify.
Mm-hmm. Okay, I can see that. So anyway, had B'Elanna and Kim not displayed their sense of honor, they would not have had this ally, and I don't think they would have survived very long, because it seemed like, and this kind of harkens back to working with the radioactive materials, they were more susceptible to the bad effects than the Nogra were, and so they were able to help out a little bit and keep them from getting killed prematurely.
They were dying of radiation poisoning, I think, literally after the first day.
Yeah, it hit pretty hard. Of course, you know, when you are exposed like that, it probably wouldn't take very long. But their survival was definitely made longer because of Ordagar. I think that's how you pronounce it, Ordagar or something like that, because he cared, you know, and he kind of shared a philosophical point of view that agreed with what Harry and B'Elanna had.
I think there was one incident in the story that kind of drove that point home, drove that honor point home, to where before that he wasn't sure, after that he recognized.
Uh-huh. So do you have any favorite points of plot in this book?
B'Elanna's reaction to the holiday, I wish would have been more fleshed out at the end, afterwards, what she was going to do to embrace the holiday, because we saw well enough how she disdained the holiday at the beginning of the novel.
Oh, yeah. I mean, she, you know, everybody was wishing her this, and she was just kind of grumbling and okay, and getting out of the way, and But when she sat down in the mess hall and Neelix brought her this special thing that he had made for her, you know, whatever kind of food it was that he brought her, and she just went nuts on him and was very angry, storming out, and she just treated Neelix very badly there. But later on, of course, she realized she had done this, and she did go back and apologize to Neelix and kind of explain the situation to him, which was probably a good thing, because she said many times if she had, well, I don't know about many times, but she did say that if she had gotten lost and was not able to see Neelix again and not be able to tell him she was sorry for what she said and what she did, that would be very hard to live with.
And when she explodes in the mess hall, what happened to the food that he presented her with?
Didn't it become ballistic? Didn't it start flying around the room?
They're already short on consumables, and she destroys several thousand calories of consumables, and she's not called on the carpet for that.
You know, as far as she's concerned, she couldn't care less. She could, you know, she has had enough of hearing about the Day of Honor. She is angry and she is not thinking. And
Janeway should have had her in Janeway's office and calmly discussing the reprimand about to slide into her folder.
Don't you think that might have been a little too far aside from the story?
But the story is about consequences. The story is about looking at your honor, accepting your honor, and dealing with your honor. So the consequences of your actions become very important within this. Besides, Michael could have, you know, gotten a couple more pages out of it.
Yeah. So as far as a favorite point of plot for me, I'm kind of the opposite of what you're thinking, I think. You know, at the very least, B'Elanna isn't going to be acting like a maniac when someone wishes her happy Day of Honor in the future. She chooses to observe the ceremony on the holodeck to learn more. And maybe she, through that, she may start to embrace her Klingon heritage a little more. But she is at least at peace with this part of it. And maybe through reflection, which is what the Day of Honor is about, is reflecting on the previous year's activities. Who knows? She could resolve to be better at being a Klingon human hybrid.
But I think that's exactly what I was talking about, is as members of a Klingon club, we really seen what the activities of a true Klingon Day of Honor actually were. We want to look to see things, rituals, something that we can grab onto, reenact, and make our own to help sell Klingon culture to the rest of American society.
Good point. Now, just as kind of an aside, this isn't in our notes, it just occurred to me, not only do we have B'Elanna Torres as a Klingon human hybrid, we have another one in Kalar, who also did not completely embrace her Klingon side. So I thought maybe we could spend a little bit of time comparing these two. What would be your impressions of Kalar and B'Elanna?
Kalar embraces her Klingon heritage a lot more than B'Elanna does. Not as much as Worf does, but then Worf has an idealized vision of what a Klingon is supposed to be. Kalar's is probably closer to what a real Klingon looks at himself as than Worf does. So it's a lot stronger with her, and she's more accepting of it than B'Elanna is. And now for the necessary commercial in the program. The actress who played her will be at Treklanta this May. Thank you for listening.
So Kalar, she did embrace her Klingon-ness more than B'Elanna did, but she still had some problems with some of it, especially the ritual part of being Klingon. Because, you know, when Worf, after they had their encounter on the holodeck, Worf was going to take the oath with, I guess, the oath of marriage with Kalar, and she said, you know what, it, every, you know, we can't have just have fun. I mean, this has to ignite some ritual or something. You know, every time something ritual comes up with Klingons, Kalar's like, what a bunch of tripe.
But I think that gets back to the fact that Worf has an idealized vision of Klingon culture. To Worf, that's the natural thing. You have a one-night stand, you get married. To most Klingons, that's not the way it is. Look at the two Klingon women that wanted to spend the evening with Riker.
Yeah, okay. That makes a lot
of
sense.
Would they have married him?
No, not at all. And of course, they did allude to there was some promiscuity happening on the Pock. but yeah, another example of how Klingon society had changed would be with Gowron becoming the chancellor of the High Council, because all Picard had to do was name either Gowron or Duras as chancellor of the High Council. But Worf advised him that in order to give more time for the investigation as to the assassination of the previous chancellor, they needed to do this ritual where Gowron and Duras had to stand up and declare the tale of their lives and what achievements they had made that would make them worthy to be chancellor. And it just added a lot of time, but it was not necessary to do that anymore. So yeah, I think the ritual thing might have been getting in the way of expediency. And let's face it, if you're in the space age, things need to move fast, and long drawn out rituals may not be conducive to that. But yeah, I like the way you put that. Worf learned his Klingondom from a book. From books, from studying what was ideal. And then he had missed out on a lot of the practical ways that would happen in modern times.
But I have to break it to you. I think in space, a spacefaring culture would have a lot of time to deal with rituals, because space, as I said before, is incredibly vast. You have long periods of nothing happening until you have to look some quick activities at the port you want to be at before you go and do a long ride again.
Yeah, but you only have 47 minutes for 43 minutes, I should say, for a television show. And, you know, if you're going to go from one side of the galaxy to the other, you got to do it quickly. Unless you're on Voyager when you have 70,000 years.
And they're not really going from one side of the galaxy to the other. They're just having to cross a couple of quadrants.
Yeah. But, you know, I think when I think about Star Trek, the speeds are so quick that what would take 40,000 years would take a day, maybe, to get to. I don't know exactly what the speeds are, except that warp one would be the speed of light. And then as you go it into different warp factors, you double the speed of getting from one place to another. Am I wrong about that? Or is there,
it's an exponential thing.
Yeah. So, you know, it would, if you go fast enough, you're going to get there sooner. And
but remember, warp 7, I think it is the speed limit now.
Okay. Yeah, I don't remember. Of course now. Okay, but we're talking Voyager, and I don't think they're observing the speed limit. So we got a theme here, a meaning of honor. I think we've talked about that. So, but the other thing I wanted to discuss was, would Pacria's voluntary death had served honor, or should she have taken the Zendikar's cure to allow her to fight them, and then by using their own weapons against them? You know what I mean?
Yeah. I'm not exactly sure how to look at that. That is a deep philosophical question that didn't get looked at a lot in the book. I mean, Kes throws that out when she gets Pakria to agree to take the cure, but it wasn't gone into enough to come to a decision, or at least to present enough contrary opinions to let the reader decide for themselves whether or not she should have taken the cure.
Well, she decided to take the cure because she felt that it would hurt the Zendikar by doing so, because they wouldn't want her to have that cure. That was not for her. That was for their own people. And by her using it and surviving, it was an insult to them. So, you know, I don't know. I don't think she would be, I don't think letting yourself die when there's a cure available. I don't know how I would handle that myself. If the cure was found under precarious conditions, as it was in her situation.
But then there's the argument that the cure exists. The cure is founded on the suffering of many people. But do you write off all of their suffering and say it's null and void, I'm therefore not going to take the cure? Or are you going to use their sacrifices and take the cure to keep moving forward in the chance that you might run into these guys again and be able to inflict revenge on them?
Right. And that, see, and I think that's kind of a moral dilemma that we have just kind of hanging out there, and we have to decide for ourselves what we would do in that situation.
Which is why I say Michael needed to give us more arguments on both sides of this issue to let us come to our own decision about what she should have done.
Yeah. Yeah, that's true. I'm not going to second guess Mike Friedman. There's apparently, this is something that, you know, it was accepted. It was licensed. He turned in all everything and they said, yeah, this is what we want. And then again, it comes up again with, why is this particular book included in this series? I'm not really sure I understand that, because it isn't, I don't know if it's as much as, or is it a veiled story of honor? I'm not really sure. I might have to read it again to make up my mind about that.
There are elements in the book that deal with honor. I think more importantly, though, there are elements in the book that make it a Voyager novel. And at the time, they wanted a novel from each of the different series that Star Trek had out there. So they went to Michael and said, give us a Voyager novel on honor, touching on honor, dealing with honor. And this is what he came up with. The problem that he has is, how do you go into all of these arguments for honor, for Pakria wanting and not wanting the cure, for what B'Elanna has done or not done, and keep the book moving like the adventure story it's supposed to be? I think if he had tried to do that, it would have been a massively large book, because he has to find ways to work in those concepts in an action environment.
Oh, yeah. And then you would have to discuss philosophies and different points of view and lots of different things. Yeah, it would be a really long book, a difficult one to write.
And keep in mind, like I said, you'd have to be discussing all those points while you're running.
Yeah, which would probably distract from the story quite a bit. I think we could probably wrap this one up. What do you think? Do you have any other thoughts you would like to have out there?
I don't know that there's much more we can beat this horse with.
Yeah. Well, I don't know. If you were to rate the book, how would you rate it?
Looking at it as a Voyager novel, probably rated about a 3. Looking at it as a novel to fit in the category of Day of Honor, 1.5. So, you know, it depends on what you're looking at. For a read, it's a really, really quick read. It's, if you like Voyager, it's a really good Voyager novel. It just depends on how you approach this book.
Okay, well, I'm going to go with a 4 out of 5 Zendika Cures for this book as just as a story to read and say I did enjoy it, you know. So, John, what are we going to be reading next?
The 4th and original final volume of this series. We'll probably be going on to the 5th and 6th book later on, which came out as an addition to this series later on. But next time we're going to be looking at Treaty's Law, which is going to be the explanation for why Klingons have the Day of Honor.
Oh, that should be fun. That was written by Dean Wesley Smith and Kristen Catherine Rush, and it is book 4 in the series.
And we're going to go back to Jim Kirk and Kor.
I always, always enjoy Kor. He is the best.
Which is why he's a Dahar master.
Oh, yeah. So we can be found on CAG.org. Our podcasts also appear on iTunes and other places where you get fine podcasts. If you'd like to get in touch with us, you can email us at podcast@cag.org, and we'll get those messages. And for Bound by Honor, I am Jim.
And I am Jorn.
And join us next time on Bound by Honor. Kapla! You have been listening to Bound by Honor, the Klingon Assault Group book review podcast. Bound by Honor is brought to you by the Klingon Assault Group and is produced by Admiral Kirk Zantai Loon Keech. If you hear the call of the warrior, visit our homepage at www.cag.org to learn more about what it means to be Klingon. Perhaps you have what it takes to be one of us. Listener feedback is always welcome at podcast@cag.org. Kaplop!